Nearly 20 years ago, one of the most popular brands of beer in the U.S. launched an ad campaign that went on to become one of the most successful in many years. The most interesting man in the world not only helped this brand achieve market dominance, it was also copied and parodied widely, a true compliment in disguise. Today, my guest is certainly a candidate to be the most interesting man in the Engler College of Business. Dr. Murray Jennings, the Gensler Professor of Computer Information Systems, has seemingly done everything and mighty well at that. Roll the intro.
You're listening to Buff Speak, the official podcast of the Paul and Virginia Engler College of Business at West Texas A&M University. I am Dr. Nick Gerlich, your host, as we meet up with the thought leaders making an impact today.
Dr. Jennings has only been at WT since 2021, and in these few years has firmly established himself as one of the most knowledgeable among us, as well as a prolific publisher of academic articles. But his CV, which is an amazing 40 pages long, lists not only scores of scholarly accomplishments, but also experiences in corporate life as well as the military. His CV reads like one of the best autobiographies ever written. Murray, welcome to the show. It's great to have you here.
Well, thanks for having me, Nick.
It's good to have you here in the studio. Tell us your story. Let's go all the way back. Okay, where did this all start? Where were you born and raised? Where did you initially go to school?
Well, I was actually born in northern Arkansas. I'm a hillbilly by birth, probably one of the few you ever meet. Now, I didn't stay there long. My parents moved, and I was raised in Kansas and then Missouri, and mostly Missouri. And so I was in a small town called Clint, Missouri, which is smaller than Canyon. It's only about 8,000 people. And then I went to college first at Southwest Baptist University down in Bolivar, Missouri, and then up at William Jewell College in Liberty, Missouri. And William Jewell is a nice Division II college, just like WT, so a small school. Enjoyed it thoroughly, prepared me. And while I was there, I was working my way through college, being a poor farm boy, like I think many of our students are. And the Navy offered a great deal that if I was to sign up to be a nuclear propulsion officer, they would pay me a salary my senior year in college and help me finish up school. And so that's what I did.
Sounds like a good deal to me.
Well, yeah. Until you have to serve.
But. Well, yeah, of course. Yeah, you got to pay back.
Right.
So what did you study at William Jewell?
Well, I was a chemistry and physics major. I was in the hard sciences. And surprisingly enough, I didn't even think about business at that time. Or computers. Because at that time, computers, we had one computer class. It was a PDP-11, which used punch tape and paper cards. And to me, that seemed like an incredibly boring thing to do with your life.
Yeah, I remember those years carrying around punch tape and cards around, and you guarded them with your life because that was your memory at that point. That was it. There were no floppies or anything like that. We had paper.
Yeah.
And so if you lost it, we had to start over, right?
Absolutely.
So from there, did you go into the Navy right away?
I did as soon as I graduated. I went through a Hyman Rickover interview. I don't know if you ever heard of Hyman Rickover, Admiral Rickover. He was the father of the American nuclear Navy and a real character. And there are tons of stories about how he really tested his applicants by stressing them out to the max. And I managed to get through that. I went to the Navy, went down first to officer candidate school and then to nuclear education school, which is a 6-month intensive school that probably taught me 4 years of engineering in 6 months. And from there, I went to prototype, which is where you learn hands-on, and spent 6 months there. And then after that, went to my ship, which was the USS Bainbridge, nuclear cruiser.
And did you sail the high seas around the whole world or what?
Well, just mostly around California. Didn't make a deployment. So we didn't deploy while I was in.
And how long were you in?
I was in a little over 4 years.
And that was your commitment?
They made me get out early because they thought I was going blind.
Oh, okay. Well, that's kind of important, I would think.
Well, it turns out I had a lazy eye. We got misdiagnosed. But by the time we figured that out, I was already out working in the commercial nuclear industry.
Mm-hmm. And so the Navy was good with you. They felt like you had sufficiently done your time, I guess, after school, you know, as best as could be done. And so then what happened?
Well, then when they made me get out, I went and joined a nuclear consulting company called General Physics Corporation, living in Chattanooga, Tennessee for 6 months, doing some basic work, preparing training manuals. And then they sent me to the San Onofre Nuclear Generating Station in Southern California, which if you're going to get a duty station, civilian or not, that's one of the better places to go. And I ended up spending over 40 years there, but I spent 20 years, 10 years working for them, and then another 10 years working for the actual utility.
Well, and what kinds of things did you do?
Well, first I was preparing the training materials for all the nuclear operators so that they could get licensed and certified to run the plant. And then I switched over and started doing engineering tasks of turning systems over to the plant so that they could be put into service. So I actually helped put the plant into service, start it up, fix all the issues that came up during startup, and then stayed there helping maintain the plant while it ran for 10 years.
And how did all of this corporate experience prepare you for the next chapter in your life, which was more degrees?
Well, one of the things, while I was with General Physics, I saw that the people who got promoted had master's degrees. So I went and got an MBA because I figured, well, I should know something about business because I was writing proposals and being a project manager. And I wanted some background. And I got my MBA and enjoyed that. And then I got my master's in software engineering, which I enjoyed that because I felt at the time computers were coming in. And even though they were clunky and everything else, it was a fun experience and got that. And then I started at the site. I was in charge of a team that was doing nuclear testing on the containment isolation system and the safety systems. And I became a high impact team leader. And that really prepared me to manage and lead projects and lead teams. And it was fun because we got to do a lot of interesting things. I went everywhere on that plant. I've been inside an operating nuclear reactor containment building when the nuclear reactor is going. Even been by an LD5030 source, which is a lethal dose in 1 hour and where 50% of the people die within 30 days. So I didn't spend much time there, ran quickly, but I got to do a lot of exciting stuff. I climbed up on top of nuclear containment buildings to do inspections. I took a crossbow into the plant to use to shoot lines, instrument lines over spray headers. So that actually saved over $1 million per test by doing it. Because when the nuclear plant's down, it costs $1 million a day. And anytime you can save critical path time on a schedule, you make a big impact. And that's what we did is I figured by the time I was done, I saved that company over $20 million. So I more than paid my salary.
Wow, that's great. And what time frame was all this?
This was all back in the 80s and 90s.
Okay. And then how many master's degrees did you wind up with ultimately?
Well, I ended up getting 3 master's degrees. I got my MBA, my software engineering master's, and then I got a telecommunication management master's when I was doing my PhD. Now, what I got into computers was I was one of the first people to bring the desktop and the laptop into the plant to do testing because I just happened to have good timing. When I first started, everything was being done with typewriters and calculators. And then we got I don't know if you remember, Wang computers who had their, word processing system. Well, then when the IBM PC came out, we were the first to get that. And we started, figuring out how to use that in a business world. And I wrote the first, software for tracking design changes as they were processed through the plant because the building, construction company was, in a way, kind of making us look bad by bringing stuff over to turn over at midnight and then saying we had it all day. Well, that wasn't the case, and so I proved it by keeping track and doing timestamps, and my management was very happy with that.
Well, this was all at a time when a lot of people really didn't know exactly all the things that a PC could be used for. I mean, we had home computers that came out in the 70s, Radio Shack, and yep. I believe Apple had one, Commodore, probably. The IBM PC wasn't released until, I think, August of 1981. I think it was 11 days apart from when MTV launched. That's a great trivia question there, by the way. but you figured out how to actually use this thing as opposed to just filling up a lot of valuable desktop real estate.
In fact, I was considered a power user, and today people don't understand, but I was considered a stud because I had two 10 megabyte hard drives.
Oh, wow.
And, you know, that's nothing today. We would, in a day when we have hard drives with gigabytes on them. But we had to do a lot of we had to be very optimized in our coding and very optimized in our systems because everything ran either on a floppy disk, which was a very small capacity, or you had to just reload it every time. So there was a lot of good learning there and a lot of experience. I mean, one of the funniest things that happened is when I built my first system, I was running it, and I had one of my operators who kept crashing the system. And they swore I had a mistake in my code. Well, I knew I didn't. So finally, I watched them. And what happened was when the green light came on the floppy disk drive, they thought that meant take it out. And so they were crashing the system doing that. Now, if you notice, after that, even IBM figured out that they needed to change the color of the light to amber. Because apparently they weren't the only ones doing that.
Green means go. Wow, that's insane. So you were writing code. What language were you using?
Well, I used compiled BASIC. I did do some assembler language and earlier stuff, but in the early days, the code that did the most stuff that was easier to do and implement was actually BASIC A, which was on the IBM PC. And then you could compile it to make it fast, and you could optimize it. So I did everything there. I also used DB2 as a database language, and we used MathCAD and other old systems. In fact, most people don't know where Excel comes from. And it comes from Lotus 1-2-3, which actually came from VisiCalc, which is what I started using initially. And VisiCalc was the application that made the PC useful.
I remember those. That makes me old, I guess, right?
Absolutely. I mean, we know what... You know, we know where this came from.
Right. Yeah. This was all early 80s stuff, man. Yes. That's amazing. So ultimately, though, you wound up getting a PhD, which means did you do that while working in corporate world?
Actually, I did.
Wow. So you balanced all of that somehow.
Yeah. It turned out that the university I picked to get my PhD from, the Claremont Graduate University, is part of the Claremont Colleges, which I had read a science fiction book from. John Bruner, called Shockwave Writer, and he actually mentioned the Claremont Colleges in that. And I thought, well, that was pretty cool. So I went up there, and they allowed me to do my PhD at night because I was paying them instead of them paying me. I didn't have to be there during the day. And it worked out nicely.
So what did you study in your doctoral program?
Well, Journal IS for the most part, but my dissertation was on organizational memory, which turned out to become knowledge management. So I always had this idea that we actually knew pretty much everything we needed to know to answer most of our questions. It was just finding it and actually figuring out where stuff was and then tying together different aspects of knowledge. And so that's what I got into, is figuring out how to get computers to go do searches and find stuff. Because I had a problem once where I spent almost a year solving it, only to find out that the engineer next to me had a similar problem, but not the same. And it solved it like 6 months before. And if I had been able to do that search, I could have found that information and solved my problem much faster. So that convinced me that we needed to do better search. And that's why AI, I think, is so powerful today, is it does this type of search automatically. But, you know, back in the early days, if you didn't organize your data well, you couldn't find anything.
And what year are we talking now?
We're talking still in that mid-80s to late 80s.
So this is long before the internet as we know it, and more than a decade before Google.
Yes. Now, I got my PhD during the 90s, and that's where I did a lot of research. But a lot of my inspiration came from the stuff I did in the 80s in bringing these computers in and making them useful.
So by the early 90s, your institution was probably connected to the internet.
Yeah.
Okay. But it still wasn't like what we have today, and it probably wasn't all that fast. And there were some rudimentary search engines back then, but they paled in comparison to what can be done now.
There were spiders that would go out and find stuff, but there wasn't a whole lot online. It was just a lot of static pages that people put out that you could find if you looked, but it didn't have lots of good information. there wasn't a wealth of stuff that's out there today. There was no YouTube. There was no Instagram, TikTok. None of that existed. In fact, it was CompuServe, I think, which is a dial-up service.
Yeah, CompuServe and Prodigy.
Yeah, and people will laugh. My students still laugh because I still have an AOL address. I was one of the first users of AOL. And the reason I kept that is I have friends who are, well, drinking buddies and such from all over the world who know that address. And so up until really like 2010, it was one of the very few international email systems that you could go anywhere in the world and still access. And that's why I kept it.
See, it's kind of funny in academic circles, at least in schools of business, AOL is assurance of learning.
Yes.
But it stood for something very different back then. Yeah, it was America Online.
Right.
Yeah. And I think they just recently killed the final vestiges of their dial-up system. There were actually like 2 million people still using it.
Yep.
That's hard to believe.
Well, I did jobs in Armenia where we had to use dial-up, and it was incredibly slow to transfer files. I think we were getting a dial-up signal of around 2,400 baud, which is, yeah, for people who are used to broadband, real slow.
Yeah, don't try to send any images or,
no.
or video. That no. would never happen. You would choke it.
Right, just pure text files.
So you mentioned Armenia. Where all have you worked overseas?
Well, after I got my PhD, I was still with Southern California Edison working as an engineer, and I became a project manager for Y2K, the Y2K issue. And so I helped our nation, actually solve that issue and prepare for that issue by working through the utility industry and doing everything on our national level. And then I got asked to take a team over to Ukraine, Armenia, and Georgia to do risk assessments on their infrastructure because we had people there, and President Clinton wanted to know if he should evacuate them. So I took him over, spent a couple months in Ukraine, and did a lot of work there. While there, I was invited by Pacific National Engineering Laboratory to go to Prague to talk about the Y2K issue. So I went there, came back. We did a lot of work in Ukraine and got them okay. And they didn't have a problem, not because they solved it, but because they didn't believe in computers.
Wow.
I mean, I would
go
to
believe.
Yeah, we'd go to a power plant that was the size of San Onofre. And where we had 2,000 computers, they had 6.
And how are they carrying on like this? This was the Stone Age for them. They were living the Stone Age.
They were doing everything on paper and everything with analog devices. They didn't believe the computers were reliable. And at the time, they probably weren't. And they had a point there. And that's an interesting thing is that that's one reason why I think the Soviet Union fell. In fact, the first cyber attack was carried out by the U.S. against the Soviet Union when they wanted to buy some of our controllers and pumps and valves for the Trans-Siberian oil line. And we wouldn't sell it to them, but Canada would. But Canada allowed us to install a Trojan horse in them. Their software people didn't pick it up. They installed it, and on a certain date, it flipped a switch, and that pipeline, part of that pipeline blew up.
So when did you join academia as a professor?
Actually, 2001, right after the rollover. So you asked where I've been and when I joined academia, but I've taught classes in Ukraine. I've taught in Egypt. I went to Peru to help them prepare for Y2K. Been all over Europe. And because I also do a lot of PhD dissertation defenses and such. So I get invited to a lot of places, Australia, Asia, China. Went to China to do a crisis response conference as a keynote speaker. We went to Harbin, China, the largest city you never heard of, 11 million people, but it's also the home of where they build the Chinese Navy. And so I have always had an escort when I was there. I've got a big kick out of that because, well, I guess they assumed I was a spy.
That's funny. They probably assumed most of us were spies if we were there at that time.
Yeah, although we had a doctor, an American naval doctor that was there, and he was okay. They didn't worry about him too much.
Mm. Okay. So what school did you start at teaching?
San Diego State University.
And you wound up staying there, right?
For 20 years.
20 years. So you started in a tenure track position, assistant
yep.
professor?
Well, actually, my first semester I was adjunct because they didn't quite have the tenure track position open yet. And I took that adjunct under the provision that I would be able to apply for the full-time tenure track line. And it seemed providence because the same day they offered me that job, Southern California Edison offered me a severance package. So I figured that just meant to be.
Yeah, perfect timing there. And so you worked your way up through the ranks. You got tenured, became associate, then you became full. And tell us in a nutshell, what was that 20-year period like?
Well, one of the things I had learned was I learned a lot in engineering and being in the utility industry. So I had lots of questions, lots of things I wanted to look at. And because I had a lot of experience, I was able to jump in and start doing research right away. I'd never done research because never had a reward for it. But once I was required to, I jumped right in and started doing things. And because I had a good severance package, I was able to fund myself to go to a lot of conferences, which is what I tell young professors today. If you get a chance, get papers in the conferences, present them, get comments, and then turn them into journal articles. And that worked quite well. And it also got me known into the academic world. I met a lot of people, went to a lot of different conferences in a lot of different countries and talked a lot and actually grew my network of networking of academic professors, and which I use today to help run a conference. I help run a conference in Hawaii, the Hawaii International Conference on System Sciences, which is the top IS conference in the world. And I got involved there because of my dissertation chair, but I stayed. And because of that, I've been doing them for quite a while and helping them out. And I think that actually helps build a lot of ability to produce good research.
So you retired in 2020. That was COVID year.
Yeah, at the end of 2020.
Okay. And so what brought this on? Was you just ready to move on or what?
Well, they offered me early retirement. Well, early being I was 64, so it wasn't that early. But they wanted to offer a way for older professors to get out. I don't know why they decided to do that because they haven't done it since and they didn't do it before. But I took advantage of that. And my wife and I didn't know where we wanted to retire, so we took a trip just before COVID all through the Southeast and Southwest. And Amarillo wasn't on our list, but we drove through Amarillo on that trip, spent a night, actually enjoyed it, went around, didn't like what we were seeing a lot of places, and came back here for a week. And that's when I did my research and found out about WT. And I emailed Amjad and asked what he could tell me about the university. And I came down, we had a meeting. I was in shorts, which, as you know, Amjad is not a fan of, but I didn't have anything else. It was in August, and that's just the way it was. But we got along fine, and so in a way, I recruited WT, but WT recruited me, and he said, yeah, if I could get here, because he wanted to make sure I was serious about coming here before giving me a job.
And that was one of the first things he did as dean. He became dean right before COVID happened. Yeah. And so you were a significant early hire during his tenure as dean, and worked out pretty well, didn't it?
I think so. I've enjoyed it here. I like the place. I like Amarillo. I like the Panhandle. And I like WT. I think we're a good university.
But, you know, we're probably a lot different from San Diego State as well. I mean, I'm sure they're a lot bigger, right?
Oh, yeah. San Diego State's about 35,000 students, and we're about 5,000 on campus. So, yeah, big difference in size. And we have a lot of surfer people at San Diego State. But here we have a lot of good people who maybe they would surf if we had an ocean, but they don't. But still, they're still good kids. And from that standpoint, we had good kids there, and we have good kids here. And that's one thing that's been consistent.
And so you really weren't ready to retire just yet, right?
No. I still don't think I'm ready to retire.
There's nothing wrong with that. No. As long as you still got it in your soul to keep going and you have a hunger for more knowledge, that's great, man, because you're just going to keep disseminating that to the students and keep publishing and going and going, setting an example, right?
Absolutely.
Dr. Jennix has had an illustrious research career. When he says his CV is 40 pages long, he is not kidding. You could weigh this on a scale if you were to print it out. He has enough publications that an entire department of CIS profs could get tenure and promotion. That's up next.
Life sometimes has a way of interfering with our university education. Marriage, family, work, any or all of these can cause us to hit the pause button on our degree, with hopes of one day finishing it. The only problem is that returning to campus can get a lot harder when you're no longer 20 years old. And that's precisely why we launched our online BBA, with majors in accounting, finance, general business, marketing, management, human resource management, and computer information systems. Available completely online. You can return to school without having to step foot on campus, or maybe you want to transfer in from a two-year program elsewhere, but once again, are not able to attend face-to-face. Our online offerings are for you as well. We can help you finish your degree and climb higher on your career ladder, at your pace and in your time. We're AACSB accredited and among the most elite of business schools around the world. Reach for the stars and do it with a WTBBA in hand. For more info, find us at wtmu.edu/COB or call 806-651-2525.
When most young profs are coming up for promotion and tenure, it's fairly normal to see them with maybe 6 to 8 publications in their first 5 years. And then there are another 4 to 6 pubs that typically get added by the time they go up for promotion to full professor. And of course, these numbers can vary by discipline and by individual, but these are just things that I've seen through the years. When you consider, though, that Dr. Jennix has 83 referee journal articles, along with countless dozens of conference proceedings and presentations, books, book chapters, and more, that's when you realize this man is a publishing machine. Murray, tell us about your research agenda, where you started and where you are now.
Well, my research agenda has primarily been focused on finding better ways to find and use knowledge. So knowledge management has been my number one focus. It was my dissertation, and I got in at a good time. The term KM hadn't actually been coined yet when I was doing my PhD. It came out while I was finishing up. And so I got in on the ground floor, so to speak, of researching that particular topic. And it's paid off because I'm now considered the number 3 career researcher in the world for knowledge management. And I've done a lot of good articles. I got in early because I've always been focused on how to measure knowledge use and how do you measure the impact of using knowledge. It's great to say, yeah, we need to teach kids knowledge, but what good does it do if you don't see an impact? And the early KM research didn't actually look at getting an impact. They just wanted to make sure people had access to knowledge, like a library.
And what are some of the publications you're most proud of?
Well, one of my early ones was a KM success model that my dissertation chair and I did that was based on the Delone and McLean IS success model. And that's probably been my biggest cited article with about 600 citations. And actually, when you include all the other articles that went with it, over 1,000. And that one has been, to me, the most significant. But then I also did an article on proving what were the factors that one needed to measure to see if you were successful in knowledge management. And I like that. Then I got into other stuff because some of the other things I got interested in was crisis response. Now, I got interested in that because, one, I'm a nuclear person in Y2K. But also, I got caught into a coup attempt in Armenia in 1999. And my company had no idea what to do. They tried to tell me to drive out, which you can't do from Armenia. And so I got enthused with the idea that perhaps emergency planning was something we should do. So I started researching that. And I started the International Journal of Knowledge Management. And I also started the International Journal of Information Systems for Crisis Response and Management. And both of those journals, one's still going. One of them's kind of been put away because it wasn't supported enough by the community. The crisis response community in academia is not huge. But that research was great. We did a lot of research. And some of the things I did there was looking at social media as a viable alternative for communication during a crisis, which early it wasn't. Relying on telephones and cell phones wasn't good because people don't understand the infrastructure on the cell towers. And if you have a blackout like yesterday when Canvas was down, well, that's infrastructure. And we just assume that's there. And in crisis response, you can't assume that. And that's part of what I did for Y2K was prepare in case we did lose the grid and had no absolute grid. So how would we restart society? So did research there. And in the process, did probably my most impactful research from and personally satisfying research, which was looking and identifying victims of human sex trafficking in online advertising. And I did this with students. And I initially wasn't interested, but I had a student who was. And she got me interested, and we did our initial research on identifying a method to identify potential victims. And we published that, and people liked it. And I kept talking about that in class, and I got another student who liked it. And she did her master's thesis on it. And in the process of doing her master's thesis, we discovered the emoji code that was being used to traffic human people. And we published that code. And that had a fairly big impact. We got a hero award from the Soro Optimist Organization for that. And we interacted with Texas police, California Attorney General, New York Attorney General. So we actually put that out for a lot of people to use.
I have to note here for our listeners that we academics live and die by very small numbers. Now, I've read your CV. And I've seen all your bona fides. They are outstanding. But when you say you've had 600 citations, in the general population, somebody who writes like a magazine article and has 600 readers or 600 people talking about it, that's small change. But in academia, to have 600 people cite your paper, that's rock star status.
Yeah. I'm about 7,200 citations currently.
And that's total, overall, right?
Overall.
Right. And what's your Google Scholar score?
Well, for my H index is 48. So that just means I have 48 articles that each have been cited at least 48 times. Now I got a lot more articles and a lot more citations, but that's just a way of measuring that. But it has resulted in the Stanford Elsevier index ranking me in the top 2% of cited scientists in the world.
Well, see, that's great. We're happy to have you here. I'm glad you didn't retire for good. So what are some of your more profound findings and contributions to the literature?
Well, probably my most, what I consider my most profound finding was defining what success was for knowledge management, what the impacts were. And it isn't just using knowledge. It's actually reflected in how the organization behaves and their knowledge sharing behaviors. And so I identified all the critical success factors that needed to be there and what you needed to focus on, including governance and knowledge management strategy. And even today, that's important. And that's kind of leading us now into the impact we're looking at, which is how do you integrate artificial intelligence into knowledge management? The emoji code was important. I also did a model on outsourcing success in the early 2000s. It's been cited quite a bit and used quite a bit. I've done a risk model on how to predict when somebody was going to leave an organization. And the reason we did that was because, well, one, my generation started retiring. But also, when somebody retires, they take that knowledge away from the organization. And if you don't try to capture it, you lose it. And I see lots of organizations forget how to do stuff because the people who did it just left.
What research do you have going on at the moment or coming up?
Well, right now we're working on research. I'm working with Dr. Abby Sin and actually a small group here at WT. Our newest professors joined that group, and Kareem Dana is in that group, and Jeffrey Babb's in that group. And we've been working on AI in knowledge management. We were running a mini track in the Hawaii International Conference this January, and we have a couple papers there. And I'm also getting ready to do a special issue for a computers journal on AI and KM. So I'm looking at how to integrate artificial intelligence into a knowledge management strategy and a knowledge management organization within an organization.
And how can companies in the real world actually do this stuff apart from the sophisticated journal articles and so forth that get published? You know, how do they actually run and use this as non-academics?
Well, they use it mostly for knowledge discovery. And actually, AI has been used for knowledge discovery for many years. I taught a decision support systems class where we talked about decision theory. And one of the things we talked about was Watson, which was an IBM AI product back in the early, late 2000s, 2010s. And its primary use was in summarizing literature for doctors. A doctor can't keep up. And actually, most people can't keep up with the literature in their field. And AI is great at summarizing that. Now, the problem is you've got to be careful because they do make mistakes.
Yeah. And AI, a lot of people think it just was invented in November 22 when OpenAI released ChatGPT, you know, out into the wild for all of us to use it. But AI's been around for probably 70 years in very rudimentary forms.
Yeah, and everybody's been using it without realizing it. All your noise-canceling headphones, that's AI-based. That was done with early AI. A lot of the maintenance systems for automobiles, jet planes, uses oil analysis, which is using an AI function. I worked on a system that did that back in the 2000s, early 2000s. It's just been useful in a lot of ways because it finds patterns. And really, knowledge is about patterns and identifying the patterns and making and finding where they're useful. And that's what AI helps us do. It helps us find the patterns. Humans have to find out if it's useful. Now, we're trying to get ChatGPT to tell us what's useful. And it does okay, but an expert will outperform AI almost every time.
For now, right?
I think even in the future. I think AI, I'm a proponent of the augmented human, which is someone, an expert who uses AI. So I'm not saying don't use AI. I say use AI to do your grunt work, to do the basic research and summarize stuff for you so that you can integrate that into an overall nomological network of knowledge that you use yourself to solve problems.
In other words, work smarter, not harder.
Absolutely.
What words of advice do you have for young profs just getting started in their research?
Oh, I always say be curious. Don't discount any problem you see. Our students have tons of problems that they bring from their experience in the business world. And like I've published over 16 articles with students because we work together to solve those problems. And in solving those problems, I got a publication out of it. They got a publication out of it. And that leads to a lot of research. I think a lot of times academics don't have the context to really understand what good problems are to research. And our students actually do, because a lot of them, especially here, are working.
Dr. Jennix has done extensive research in the field of cybersecurity for small and medium-sized enterprises. That's coming up after the break.
The demand for professionals in data analytics and information systems far exceeds the supply, which is why the Paul and Virginia Engler College of Business developed the Masters of Science in Computer Information Systems and Business Analytics degree program. Already, external reviewers have ranked it among the highest IS programs in the nation. We are an AACSB-accredited college and among the most elite business schools around the world. Available completely online, this program will help you transform businesses and propel them far into the 21st century. Data mining, data analytics, and data science are keys to your success, and we provide the key to unlock your future. Reach for the stars with a West Texas A&M Master's in Computer Information Systems and Business Analytics. For more info, find us at wtamu.edu/COB or call 806-651-2500. From the Texas Panhandle to the world, we're here to help you reach those stars.
Murray, you have listed this as one of your biggest research interests. Tell us what's involved and how and why you became interested in it.
Okay, well, going back to Y2K, everybody thinks Y2K was overblown. Well, it wasn't, actually. I was in charge of Southern California Edison Systems. I had 600,000 devices. 400,000 of them failed on Y2K. But the number one finding that we had about Y2K was how insecure our systems were. We were doing things at the time, and this is something that is still happening today. We automate without thinking about security and how to protect stuff. And in particular for us, we automated substations by using modems, dial-up modems, and didn't think that anybody else could just dial in and give a password and run that substation if they wanted. Well, that's what we found out, was that we didn't have good cybersecurity. Now, we didn't tell people that because you don't want to tell people you're vulnerable. And so we didn't. But even in the early 2000s, there were a couple of hydroelectric power plants that were turned off by hackers and such. And that's what got me started, was trying to solve these problems that we'd found during our Y2K work. And I also became convinced that small companies were the real weakness in our overall economic system. So I started focusing on the small and medium enterprise because large companies have lots of resources. Small companies don't. So I had a student who was interested in cybersecurity. We did a model early about how much knowledge it took to hack versus how much knowledge it took to protect something. And that diagram became, in a way, very famous because it showed that you could be stupid and be a good hacker, but you have to be incredibly smart to be a good security person.
So how do you define small and medium-sized, and what is it that makes these companies so vulnerable?
Well, I look at small companies being usually less than about 50 people, maybe less than 100. I also like micro companies, and the reason they're vulnerable is because most of these companies focus on making money, producing, staying in business, producing a product. Well, they don't think as much about security because they don't have a resource for it. The manager or the owner of the company knows how to make their product, but they don't really know how to protect themselves. And so that's where we were jumping in, because that's also what that model I mentioned showed, was that you needed expertise. So we were providing expertise, and I started a project where we were doing audits of small companies to show them where they were weak. And I started doing this about 2014 in San Diego, and I do it here also, where we will go into a small business. We will just sit down with them. We'll go over their systems. We'll look at what they have, and we'll tell them where they have some problems. And we've been finding problems all over the place. It's sometimes they're funny. Sometimes, they're scary. But I think that's been our biggest impact from a cybersecurity standpoint in that research, is that we've been helping small businesses.
And tell me how you actually take these academic research findings and make it usable for these small and medium enterprises. I mean, they're not going to be reading these journals.
No, they don't. We read the journals. We create an audit plan for them where we go in and look at specific things. As part of the training for the students, their goal is to write up a report that presents to them, to the owners of these businesses, the top five issues that they have. But they all have to be cost-effective solutions to those issues. I never let a report go out that doesn't focus on being cost-effective, because an owner isn't going to spend thousands of dollars to fix something if they don't see what the risk is. So we have to show them where they can actually reduce risk for small amounts of money and effort.
Do you see any emerging threats for small and medium enterprises in the years ahead?
Oh, the number one threat right now, and I didn't mention it, but I took some training to be a social engineer. And social engineering is the way of, well, the direct way of saying how to trick people into doing stuff. And right now, the AI is making it really easy to craft phishing emails that look really real and get people to do stuff. How do you tell the difference between an artificial intelligence-generated image or document and a human-generated document or image? You can't easily. And so that, to me, is the number one issue. I'm the financial officer for the local chapter of the Project Management Institute. I have gotten, over the last year, over 8 well-targeted spear phishing attempts to get me to send them money. And I think this is happening all over the country. There are tons of frauds going out based on AI now. In fact, just in the last couple of days, I've gotten a couple of emails trying to get me to do stuff. But I can tell our artificial intelligence generated, because, well, there are ways to find out. And that's part of what our research is one of the things we did last January was present a paper on misinformation in healthcare advertising. Well, it's the same way here, is that if you look for it, you can find the mistakes. It's just learning to be aware and don't trust. As Reagan said, trust but verify. That's probably the number one lesson I try to teach small companies. Don't trust anything coming in. If anything comes in right before closing saying you got to pay something right away, it's a fraud. It's a fraud. If you're getting any kind of pressure on something, it's a fraud.
Well, kind of like I tell my students, how I know when they're using AIs is because it just has a certain saccharine quality to it. It's still a little bit sweet, but you can taste the fakeness at the same time.
Yes. And again, I'm aware of it because I've used it, and I've been very good. Like when I went to Ukraine, Armenia, and Georgia, I used a lot of these techniques to get them to tell me information that they didn't want to tell me.
Now that's funny.
Yes. And one of my funniest findings was for American engineers, if I want to get information out of an American company, I recruit a lady who has a Russian accent. And they'll, God bless our engineers, but they'll tell those ladies just about anything they want to know.
They'll sing like a canary.
Absolutely.
Let's switch gears a bit. How have you been able to incorporate this into your classes?
Well, I like to do, I don't like to give tests or examinations. I like to do practical exercises. So the audits are part of that practical training. I also have students do risk assessments on themselves. Because in a company, we need to do a risk assessment. But doing a risk assessment on yourself is very enlightening. Like right now, the average student or average person has over 200 information assets that need to be protected. They don't realize it. But this includes their paper documents, the IoT device, internet, anyway, the IoT devices like Nest computer, Nest controllers and their Ring doorbells and such, all those things, even baby monitors, even refrigerators, smart refrigerators have been used to actually conduct hacking attacks. I used to attend the Black Hat Conference in Las Vegas while it was actually actively recruiting hackers to come in and show how they do stuff. And I've seen all sorts of things hacked, from TVs being hacked. Smart TVs can be hacked to record what you're doing as opposed to what you're watching. And, you know, I always tell people, don't put a smart TV in your bedroom. Just not a right smart thing to do. And it's just lots of devices. I've seen even smart rifles being hacked as far as targeting devices. So there's lots of things that can be hacked. And again, people have these risks in their home and don't really think about it. And even the people you know, you don't think of them as risk, but they are. They know stuff about you. And sure, if I wanted to learn about how to hack you, I might call your mom and get her to tell me about you. And or I might call an old friend and have them tell me about you. You know, again, I can get people to tell me stuff. And then I can use that to craft a very realistic sounding attack that you'll respond to.
We have to address the gorilla in the living room, and that, of course, is AI. I love this quote by Mark Cuban. There's going to be two types of companies in this world, those who are great at AI and everybody else that they put out of business. What are your thoughts about that and the role of AI in business as we march forward?
Well, Mark has gone, I think you've gone a little overboard. There's still going to be companies that will not be put out by AI, put out of business. I mean, small companies that are doing welding and construction and farming, you don't have to do AI. AI will help you, but you don't have to. So you won't get put out of business. Again, an expert will outperform AI, but getting to be an expert is tough. AI will, I really fear, impact our students quite a bit. Because a lot of companies are using that to get rid of lower-level employees, which I think is a mistake. Everything I've seen says that people don't like talking to AI. They like talking to humans. And we haven't created an AI yet that really convinces them they're human. So I think there's a lot of work to be done. I do think AI is going to become a large tool. There's a lot of talk about the AI bubble, much like there was the e-commerce bubble back in the early 2000s. I do think the AI bubble is going to pop because we haven't focused on generating value from AI. We have focused on AI being used to force value on people. Like, I know my wife just will not work with an AI. She hates AI. She hates any company that uses AI, and she's not alone. And I think that's something companies have to realize is that AI is not a substitute for customer service. And AI is not a substitute for having experts on hand, having a medical doctor. I don't know if anybody's really going to trust an AI to tell them what's wrong, especially since AI, they do a great job of finding patterns in the literature, but they're not real good at reading people. And there's that interface, and that's where humans come in. Humans deal better with other humans. And there's a lot of work in companies when it comes to marketing campaigns, it comes to managing teams, everything else. These are human related things that AI just won't be able to do. AI can help them, but the people still have to be there. So I think companies that are relying on AI to cut their workforce to a fraction of the size are making a mistake. Now, companies that don't use AI are also making a mistake. AI is a great tool. It's a personal productivity system. I think anybody will improve their productivity using AI, just like the early days of computing. You know, when we first brought a computer out, nobody said, well, how does this help you do your job? And in many ways, we wasted a lot of time making fancy drawings that didn't need to be fancy and stuff. Well, we learned, and now nobody argues that a computer helps you be more productive. Same thing's going to happen with AI. At some point, we'll realize that, okay, AI has made us more productive and made us smarter. And that's where the augmented human comes in. I think the student who learns how to use AI now, how to ask the right queries, how to structure queries, and how to interpret the data and results was going to be a step ahead of everybody else.
My guest today has been Dr. Murray Jennings, the Gensler Professor of Computer Information Science here at the Engler College of Business. And I think you will agree with me, he is the most interesting man we have around here. Fade to black, roll credits.
You've been listening to BuffSpeak from the Paul and Virginia Engler College of Business at West Texas A&M University. Our executive producer is Justin Lovell, and Allison Hunter is our associate producer. Our co-editors are Maverick Evans and Paul Torres. Lindsay Bjork is our director of marketing and outreach initiatives, which includes overseeing BuffSpeak. Dr. Jeffrey Babb is director of accreditation and is our technical consultant. Finally, Dr. Amjad Abdullah is dean of the college. You can find us online at wtamu.edu/cob for more information about our programs. Be sure to check out our many academic offerings. Come for the quality, stay for the small classes, affordable tuition, and friendly, approachable professors. And look online at our faculty blog, profspeak.com, for more insights. You can listen to BuffSpeak on your favorite podcast portal, as well as on our website, buffspeak.biz. And if you like what you've been hearing, don't be afraid to share us with your friends, colleagues, and family. Word of mouth has always been the best form of advertising. Until next time, love one another. For the Paul and Virginia Engler College of Business at West Texas A&M University, I am Dr. Nick Gerlich. And as always, go Buffs! BuffSpeak.